Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is September 30th, and this is Talking in Obscurity, companion podcast to Writing in Obscurity. I'm Kevin Carlson, and I am joined by my co-host,
Steve Kubitz.
And today we're talking about The Outsider by Stephen King.
Yeah, I gotta be honest with you. When I first started this book, I thought it was The Outsiders, which is a book about a lovable group of greasers in 1960s Oklahoma.
Not that.
Boy! Not. The opening of this book really tells you right away that it's not The Outsiders.
Yeah, I mean, was it the child death? Or the rape? We really do talk about really dark things on this podcast.
Yeah, you think eventually we get to some happy stuff, but, you know, maybe it's because life is just so good, and there's never anything bad that happens in the real world, so we can just enjoy. Damn it.
We could talk about Winnie the Pooh. We both like Winnie the Pooh.
I do like Winnie the Pooh.
And you know how there's that theory about, like, they represent all kinds of different mental illness?
I don't like that theory.
All right, let's focus back in on The Outsider and what we love about this book. I think that the thing that Stephen King is underrated for is how good he is at character voice, because he has all these, like, right in his back pocket, all these small, towny American voices, and they all sound, like, authentic. Like, it's one of those fine details of, like, there'll be a guy at a gas station or something, and he can do regional dialect in a way that, like, it doesn't feel hokey or forced. You can really, like, sense that he just knows how to capture these people.
Yeah, I think that it's a fine line when people are writing sort of small town people, because you can come off as, like, patronizing or you just don't get it.
Yeah, he, somebody do an accent real bad.
Yeah, and he it's one of those things where it's so well researched, or he did so much cocaine in the 70s and 80s that he just lived everywhere all at once.
He was all things to all people.
But he nails, like, a lot of these, like, and this is in small town, I can't remember, it's not in New England, which is rare for...
Yeah, no, like, yeah. I don't know if
they don't really specify where it is.
I don't think it actually ever comes up in the.
It's like a small kind of southern-ish town.
Yeah,
but and everything feels very authentic to small town life is like.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just find that to be. I agree with that. It's a good first point. So my first point, honestly, though, is that. So the initial mystery of this book, it's kind of a whodunit.
Yeah,
and it begins kind of that very classic. We talk about this a lot on this podcast too, which is kind of funny. This noir-esque gruff detective having to solve a murder, and everything goes kind of off the deep end a little bit. But the initial mystery of it is really fascinating, without giving anything away yet, because we're not at that part of the podcast. It's really brilliant, and it makes you, when you're reading this, kind of, you start kind of doubting your own sort of thoughts on it, because you can, it's like watching a really good, like, news story or one of those really good news documentaries about, like, whenever you see, like, some, they were best friends and they get a black and white photo until they weren't.
Yeah, I think they do a really good version of the locked door trope. That's a mystery trope. That's not really a spoiler. Like, all the way back to Sherlock Holmes, where how did this happen if the door was locked from the inside? Or it's not exactly like that, but, like, it has that kind of feel where it has a moment where how did he commit this murder if this happened? That's what I mean by that. And I think that this is a very unique version of that. And, of course, it's a Stephen King book. So, you know, spooky reasons is how it happens.
Turns out it's spooky.
I mean, I think that, like pretty much all of Stephen King's books, it's a really great setup. And, like, through the middle action of the book, I think that, like, he's always so strong in, like, introducing characters and giving characters their moment in the sun. Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminded me of The X-Files. And I loved that show back in the 90s. If you ever have a chance to go back and watch it, don't, because it doesn't age well. But it does a lot of the things that I loved about The X-Files, where it's a mystery. And it's how law enforcement deals with the unexplainable.
So, yeah, it's funny because, you know, one thing I really genuinely love about this story is I read a handful of Stephen King things. Mm-hmm. I'm not as well versed as you are in sort of the world of King. But what I like about this, especially I think compared to some of his other stories that I've read, is the supernatural elements are really like threaded slowly. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just jump into supernatural, and it really, and sort of the main character, one of the main characters' doubts is kind of the audience or the reader's doubts. Because mm-hmm. you know, I think everyone, for the most part, is logic-brained. We're bred to this sort of like world where we have to see everything through a logical lens. If it doesn't make sense, that's when things are like off.
Yeah.
So you're, even though you know you're reading a Stephen King story, so you know anything's possible. For God's sakes, he has a book about a killer clown that lives in a sewer. So I mean, like, anything's possible in the world of King. But you're still going, there's got to be a logical explanation here. There has to be.
Yeah. There's
something here, something that we're missing. There's going to be some big reveal that why this logically happened.
And I think that's a good point to shift into what we don't love about this book. My primary dislike, to build off of that, is that character. He's really like the protagonist of this story. And at a certain point, it becomes just like in X-Files, where once you see enough information, it becomes ridiculous. That, like, towards the end of the story, the insistence of, like, well, there has to be a rational explanation for all of this is ridiculous. In, like, X-Files, it was... Scully had seen a flying saucer and still managed to be like, I don't know what that was.
Could be anything. That's funny because it's my exact same. I have the same first dislike. That there was a point where I was reading this, and when the character actually says, there's got to be some rational reason for this, I really went, dude, really? Because like, it's the point of the book where he has seen some things, his wife has seen some things, that, like, ain't no logical explanation for it. It's okay just to accept that, oh, okay, there's something supernatural that I don't fully understand, I can't comprehend. Okay, I'm going with it.
Yeah, like, once the wind is blowing in that direction so hard at this point, you can't see a literal monster and be like, huh, not sure what that is. It's a fucking monster. It's a monster. Like, there's just, it's what it is. Like, there's no, like, he wasn't burned or something. It's a monster.
See, it's funny because, you know, I guess we could, you can, if you read the freaking back of the book, it touches this, there's a monster in this story, essentially.
So yeah, there's a monster on the cover.
So. Yeah, so, it's funny. So the monster in the story, and sort of the main antagonist of it, I found very ominous. And I really, I dig how ominous the monster is. Especially compared to, like, say, something like It or The Shining, where like, you know, Jack is kind of not over the top, but a little over the top. And, you know, It, Pennywise the Clown, is a clown. So, it's, you know, it's not... The ominous, like, sort of threat of the character, I really like, but it gets kind of, without giving anything away, eventually it kind of loses a little bit of its mystique towards the end of the story.
Yeah, once you, like, pull back the curtain, I think that he had the same sort of problem with Pennywise mm-hmm. in It, is once you get a little bit too much of just meeting who Pennywise is, it becomes less scary, and it becomes more just weird. Like, in the miniseries of It, not to get too far off, but like, and in the recent movies that came out, there's a reason why the ending of that falls apart, because it fell apart in the novel.
Yeah, that's my chief concern. Like, especially, I say, It Chapter 2 was not good.
I know we're in the don't love section, but, like, I found that the ending of this was satisfying. I would still say it's not a great ending, but, like,
It's an ending.
It's an ending. It's a real ending.
Versus, like, The Simpsons. It's an ending. Sometimes that's enough.
Yeah, and like, I think that's a good point to move on to quick and dirty synopsis, get into the spoiler section in this, so this is your time. If you don't want to be spoiled any further than what we have done, check out, read the book, come back, listen to the rest of us. It's not just going to be white noise for another 20 minutes.
And if you complain about spoilers, I'm not going to say I'll send the outsider to your house, because I don't have that kind of authority anymore. Ever since I lost my job.
Anymore.
I have a life outside of this podcast, Kevin.
Okay, so, synopsis. The book begins between scenes of various witnesses being interviewed by the police and Detective Ralph Anderson and his team on their way to arrest a popular Little League coach, Terry Maitland. Maitland is a family man and a local school teacher, in addition to being a Little League coach, and is beloved and respected around the community. Now he's suspected of raping and murdering a little boy. As the damning interviews go, with various people claiming to have seen the Peterson boy being picked up by Coach T, as Maitland is known by, ostensibly to give the kid a ride home because his bike chain was broken, it seems the case against the coach is airtight. Anderson has Coach T arrested publicly, right at the ball field in front of the crowd at the end of the game. Maitland is stunned and insists that there has to be some mistake. Then, after the slam dunk arrest, with all the evidence and witnesses Detective Anderson and the police have gathered, their case starts cracking. They have Maitland's DNA on the victim, but it comes out that he has an alibi. He was in a different city at the time of the murder at a conference for English teachers. His co-workers can vouch for him. Plus, he was on tape at the hotel in this other city. Things become weirder, though, because he's also seen in security footage back in the town where the murder takes place simultaneously. It's the ultimate in two places at the same time conundrum for Detective Anderson to solve. The district attorney pushes to have Maitland arraigned anyway, but he never gets his day in court. The Peterson boy's bereaved older brother shoots Coach T to death on the steps of the courthouse, getting himself killed in the process when Anderson is forced to shoot him. Later, Anderson and the late Terry Maitland's attorney and others continue to investigate the case because Anderson becomes more and more convinced that Maitland really was framed, despite all the evidence. Anderson isn't prepared to accept that Maitland was framed by a shape-shifting demon, as suggested by a new investigator, Holly Gibney, brought on by Maitland's attorney. This is a Stephen King novel, so I'll let you decide who wins this philosophical argument. Anyway, so shape-shifting demons are totally a thing, and Anderson and Gibney, along with assorted others, have to stop the thing before it impersonates another guy, who until recently worked at a strip club. They manage to corner the thing in a cave where Holly Gibney gets the drop on it and smashes it with an improvised club, and it dissolves. Stephen King endings always tend to be a little bit weird. Let's move on to our analysis of this here book.
Yeah, so it's interesting because now that we can talk more freely, the thing that I really, you know, my sort of main takeaway from this is I love, 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 I'm going to repeat it again, love, the way this book completely balances an amazing murder mystery with incredible supernatural stuff and a really freaking scary antagonist.
I love that blending between, blending of genres of like a police procedural. It's all police procedural at first. With horror and like the scenes between it doesn't have a moment where like it just cracks, it all flows together very nicely. And not that I feel like he gets shit on a lot, but Dean Koontz kind of like lives in that specific realm of horror mixed with police procedural.
Yeah,
there's a lot of books that he does like that, and they all have that feel like, and now we're into the scary part. This doesn't do that so much, where, like, the monster, early on, there is, like, well, it's clearly Coach T, because, like, they got the DNA on him. But, like, whenever you start seeing the different pieces of evidence where, like, he really was at that conference, there's photographic evidence, not just photographic, but video of him.
And fingerprints on a book from the gift shop.
Yeah. I mean, so I love how those two things merge together.
Yeah, I think for me, like so much of what's like cool about this story is that, you know, at its core, it really is a story of the worst kind of crime imaginable, and what that would do to a small town,
mm-hmm.
what that would do to a detective who's got kind of a past,
mm-hmm.
but is also kind of that obsessive, I want to do the right thing character. We all know. I mean, we all know. There's so many stories about detectives that are just trying to do the right thing because that's the right thing to do. And I love the way this story does not pull punches.
Mm-hmm.
It does not pull punches at all with sort of what it's about. It's about a child murderer. And the details of when the murderers, like, not just the Peterson boy, the first murder, but the description of, like, the crime that happened, in Mexico, you know.
And like, the previous crimes.
Yeah, and, like, how brutal they are. Like, and, like, there's something to be, like, you know, Stephen King is often accused of sometimes going a little too graphic. And I think here, if you don't like graphic description of, like, horrible child murders, you're not going to like it. But I think it's actually important because I think it puts a good story in a perfect sort of world. It does, what's going on to a character. Every story, good story needs, like, an audience sort of, or a viewer or a reader sort of character. Mm. They're experiencing something that, you know, that the reader itself is also experiencing. And Ralph is kind of that character.
Yeah, I think that Ralph worked great in the early story because, like, I'm completely with this guy and how bewildering all of this is, especially as it gets weirder and weirder and weirder. But, like, in the second half, he becomes my least favorite character. It's not that I dislike him. It's because he's the character that we were talking about in the first part of this, where he is still insisting about a rational explanation after... We're all on board on shape-shifting demon long before we get to the final scene where they're fighting this thing in a cave. It's clear at this point that you just got to accept what it is.
Yeah, I think that, that was one of my dislikes too, but it's funny, as I'm sort of recapping it, as you recapped it, the realization that I think what works is he is kind of the audience reader sort of not advocate, but like sort of he's a placeholder for that. Because we're all meant to be logical brain and we're all just, we don't want to admit the scary thing is just a scary thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it makes sense why he's so like, no, because, you know, it's got to be something logical. We can't be anything, I know what it looks like, but it has to be something else.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, I do think eventually, though, you have to just... The logical thing, unfortunately, is the illogical thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, to me, the moment for him that I felt the same level of, like, oh, my God, how are you this dense, is when his wife interacts with the outsider. And, you know, I don't even think you experience the scene as much as it's just... it's secondhand. Mm-hmm. The wife saying, I was looking and I just all of a sudden felt these eyes on me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was... Which is terrifying. Like, like when you're... The thought of when you feel like you're being watched, how horrifying that is.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if you feel like you're being watched in your own home.
Yeah.
And, like, I love the fact that, like, you don't really experience it too much. You just experience her. She's, I felt this amazing terror. And then I just heard this voice that's basically threatened and said, your husband keeps investigating this, something bad's going to happen. And I sort of hinted at it in my likes. I love the fact that this being that is so brutal to children, I mean, raped and murdered a 12-year-old boy.
I forget the exact age, but yeah, literally,
12, probably 12, 13. But then is very just ominously threatening to Ralph's wife, Grace, who's the Maitland's daughter, I think.
Yeah.
And is not there to kill him. Like, I also love the fact that the only description you get is from a little girl who's like, he's a Play-Doh face.
Yeah, he's got that weird squiggly eyes, and he's got a mushy face.
Yeah, like, and there's something to be said about how horrifying that would be. And I find the description of the monster so brilliant because it's the eyes of a child, which are automatically going to be much more fearful, but you as a reader are constantly filling in the gaps of what you imagine.
I think it's a great way of showing a slow transformation from one person to the other, because that's what the outsider does. Is it scratches somebody and it totally mimics them down to apparently the DNA, and then it goes and it murders children because that's its food. It feeds off of fear. Then after it does that and it gets its fill, it scratches another guy and slowly becomes them. But it's not a quick transfer. It's not like a werewolf.
It takes weeks.
Yeah. It's a slow in-between. And, like, it's the kind of predator that, like, it works best in the shadows because while it's in-between steps, it's apparently very weak.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I love that about how, like, it's threatening because of it's a supernatural being, but like there's a clear vulnerability to it too,
which makes it scarier in my opinion.
Yeah, it makes it more dangerous. I mean, because a cornered animal can do anything. I don't know if. Well, I'm pretty certain that to shift gears here, that the title of this, The Outsider, is kind of a reference to the H.P. Lovecraft story of The Outsider. And not to spoil that story too much, but I really thought that there was going to be more of a twist to the ending, because in that story, it relies a lot on unreliable narrator. Like, the narrator isn't who you think he is. And that's kind of the thing of the original The Outsider. So I was constantly looking for that, and the fact that, like, it's really... It's more of this thing that just is a shapeshifter. It kind of threw me through a loop. Like, I don't know if you've ever read that story, but...
No, I've never read the original, which now I kind of want to, just based on the fact that it's anywhere as cool as this or as unique as this, it's probably...
Well, The Outsider by H.P. Lovecraft is actually a short story, so it won't take you very long. But, like, Stephen King is talked about in interviews how he was very inspired by Lovecraft's writing. And I would encourage anybody, like, if you like this book, it's a very different kind of story, but it's a short story, and I did kind of spoil the fact that, like, yeah, it's an unreliable narrator, heavy story, which I was constantly looking for that turn in this. But by the end, that didn't happen. I would say that the ending was satisfying. I wouldn't say it was great, but, like, for Stephen King, a satisfying ending is what's an achievement.
That's about it's about as happy as an ending as he usually gives you. What I love about the ending is, so for a lot of this story, it relies on you thinking that about all the tropes of fiction. The gruff detective, mm-hmm. who's of course going to be the hero. And you think at the end of the story, he's going to be the one to stop this evil being. And, you know, you think of course he's going to shoot. It's going to be this beautiful, sad ending where, you know, the crux of the ending is, you know, things attracted to sadness. And, you know, the last guy, which is Claude, Claude. You know, his family has got this sad history where the two children disappeared in a cave. And
pretty much the rest of the family got wiped out.
Wiped out trying to save them. And what's sadder than that? And you can tell in my head, I remember reading this, even, you know, I was familiar with the TV show, but my heart was like, how sad would that be? Like, the thing is shot at, it causes another mine collapse, and that's, you know, what I thought the ending was going to be. But I love the fact that that is not, you think it's going to be that, but it doesn't work, doesn't happen that way. Instead, Holly Gibney beats him with a sock full of, like, it's like gear parts, like little, like, nails.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But in my head, I'm like, all I see is just him beating him with a sock full of nickels, just like... And there's something to be said about a supernatural being who can shapeshift, who's this sort of all evil entity.
And telepathic too.
Telepathic, and his kid just gets beat to death by nickels or like a bag full of something. There's something very, I wouldn't say it's funny, but there's something kind of funny about that. And I love the fact that's the ending.
I wouldn't say it's kind of funny. It is funny. Yeah. Like, vampires are taken out by like stakes. You get the silver bullets for werewolves. This guy's great weakness was this lady with a sock full of hard things.
Like, there's something... Yeah. The thing is, I like that because I think that often in fiction, the woman doesn't get the moment outside of revenge. Like, most stories love paying on the trope of, like, the woman's victimized in some way.
Yeah.
And Holly is not a character that really doesn't get victimized in the story.
No, not in this one, at least.
Yeah, not in this one. Like I said, I'm not overly familiar with the character, but at least in this story, as just a standalone story, she is not victimized by the outsider too much. She really doesn't interact with the outsider till the end of the story.
Yeah.
You know, Ralph's wife interacts with it. Grace interacts with it. I think even, you know, Ralph has that conversation in the cave before Holly really even, like, shows up. So, Holly is just there because she's sort of researching it and realizing that it's this evil sort of entity that she has to stop. And I just love the fact that her solution is the same as when you were a kid and your old box TV wasn't working. You just got beaten aside. You just beaten it and eventually it fixed itself. She was like, you know what? This is actually very effective. I'm going to keep doing this because this seems to be working. And the friggin' thing, this evil, evil entity, I mean, is then wormified and then just kind of dies.
Yeah. I love that, like, it was all front. Like, it's terrible and vicious and murderous and whatever to kids, but, like, it wasn't prepared for a stand-up fight. Maybe because it was still weak at the time, but, like, it's not even really implied to be all that strong. It's just a guy. And, like, if you get beat in the skull with a sock full of nickels, you're going to die, too, after she hits you the sixth or seventh time.
And I think that's actually what makes it sort of horrifying a little bit, is that, yeah, against an adult, this thing wouldn't... It could be ominous and scary. That's kind of why it doesn't attack adults ever. I mean, in self-defense, in the cave, it does. But for the most part, it mostly just goes after children.
Mm.
You know, or the way it does things where you know it really can't be fought back. Like the way it describes how he got the orderly's arm.
Mm-hmm.
He was, I think, impersonating this hospital where... That's how he got Terry. Was he was impersonating a nurse that was eventually arrested for murdering two little girls.
Mm.
And he was just walking by Terry and got into a little scuffle with him, like in our screaming match about the hot, and then just...
Yeah, like, I think that it's an interesting monster, and, like, the ending makes much more sense, because it's just kind of a terrible guy. Whereas in other Stephen King novels, the ending never made sense. It's like, how exactly did they manage to defeat this all-powerful, murderous clown? And his explanation in that story ranges from ridiculous to stupid.
Yeah.
And, like, it just... And every interpretation, I feel like, of how they defeat Pennywise is ridiculous to dumb.
Yeah, especially, like, in the most recent movie... Like, it's in the original one, it's very much, oh, they're not favorite anymore, so that's why it's like, yeah, it's weakened. I feel like they like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be believed when this thing is in your face. I'm not afraid of you. I didn't believe the adult version of those characters. Like, so, like, how is, like, the thing is, so is it just saying I'm not afraid of it? Is that enough? Or do you actually have to not be afraid of it?
I have no idea.
Because that's the thing. Like, you know what I mean? So, but this, I like the fact that because he's a killer of children, he doesn't have to be overly strong. Kids are weak. Seriously. Go just to a child and knock them on the ground. It's very easy.
Okay.
Don't do that.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But I think, you know, there's something like that. What also makes it, that's the most vulnerable. Children are inherently vulnerable. And we're, you know, we as a species are conditioned to want to protect children because that's, we know that's our future.
I think that's a lot of like how, where the horror of this story comes from is because it's a child killer. And that's always been sort of very egregious. So let's get to our final thoughts on this. I think that this story does what all good like genre fiction does very well. It's a story that like it's very powerful for its own right. I love how he blends different things together, where. It's between the more noir side of this story and the horror of this story. I think that really is a cool tact because usually whenever you mix horror, it's usually like sci-fi or an action story. It really scratched that itch for me that like I haven't gotten since really X-Files.
Yeah, you know, my sort of takeaways, I love this book. I really did. You know, I'm not the biggest Stephen King fan. I like Stephen King. He's very, you know, one of the greatest writers of all times. So, you know, but I've never been like overly wowed by a Stephen King story.
Yeah,
I'm usually, you know, that's good. This really wowed me, just because I find that it's interesting because this is relatively new in terms of what this book came out 2017, 2018.
Yeah, I'm not
something like that. It's a relatively new story. So you know, a lot of times when great writers. Release new stuff. It's kind of like a great artist releasing a new album. Mm-hmm. It's very rarely the best thing they do.
Yeah, like, I feel like that this can hold its own with a lot of his old classics like The Stand, It, The Shining.
Yeah,
Christine. You can go on the greatest hits.
Yeah, like, I mean, he's got plenty of great hits. I mean, that's...
I'd like to say The Dark Tower, but I've only ever read The Gunslinger and I didn't like The Gunslinger. Sorry.
Yeah. But, like I said, what I like about this story so much and what really affected me about it was there were times where I was reading it and I felt genuine dread.
Mm.
And that's rare for me because I'm very desensitized to horrible things.
You are very jaded.
Yeah, half my like movie watching is messed up things. But that's what I mean. You know, I love a good messed up story.
Can't get to sleep unless they're screaming in the background.
Yeah, exactly. I'm old fashioned that way. But like, there's something though about like this story that I guess because it is about this sort of weak, feeble killer of children that looks like Play-Doh. And there's something to be said that like also the fact that it's a child's descriptor, Play-Doh face.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love how like the description of I felt eyes on me.
Mm-hmm.
It's so simple, but so powerful. And that left me very, very unsettled. There were times where, during one of the times I was reading this, my wife was dog sitting, so she was just alone in my house, and I listened to it before bed. And I remember, like,
good choice,
real good choice. And I remember like that was that scene where the little girl's describing how she felt when the outsider was talking to her.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, look, kind of like my dad. I just felt eyes on me. And it was the most horrid. I was so scared. And I'm like sitting there, and I'm like, for some reason, it really affected me. Just the description, I felt eyes on me.
Yeah.
Really affected me. And this story, I think, has several things like that, where you just feel so affected. Because it's, one, about a killer of children. Two, a really good mystery. Three, there's genuine terrifying things in here. And I think that's a really, really fine line to walk. And I think Stephen King freaking nails it in this story.
Yeah. All right, so that's our take on The Outsider. We hope to see you next month.